Hi, you're watching Agenda Awani Plus, and tonight we're going to talk about COVID-19 still. The fact is, more than 1 million people all over the world have been infected, more than 70,000 tragic deaths because of this virus. And where are we now? So, we know about Malaysia. You've seen that across the day today. But now we're going to go to the international experts and look at what other countries and nations has done well and done well on this. South Korea at one time was rivaling China for the number of infected cases and all. But today, they have gone below 50 number of new COVID-19 positive. That is after maybe 50 days, the first ever time they're under that number. And in Australia, University of Sydney, I think, was the one that, you know, had a new modelling, and they put out that maybe by mid-April, that's the peak of the peak, and the curve will go down and down and down. So I have with me tonight two very important thought leader, researcher, scientists on this. The first, our own Malaysian Mahathir Science Award laureate, Professor Dr. John Shepherd McKenzie. He is the Adjunct Professor of Tropical Infectious Diseases, Division of Health Sciences from Curtin University of Technology, Australia. And then from South Korea, I have Dr. Yang Mi Ji, the advisor for the Global Center for Infectious Diseases, Seoul National University College of Medicine. Now, Professor Dr. John Shepherd McKenzie has been given the laureate of the Mahathir Science Award before because he has looked at many viruses, including the virus that has been predominantly around the tropical areas like Malaysia, Indonesia. For example, he has looked at almost every virus that we have known here in Malaysia, like the JE or Japanese encephalitis, like Hendra, also at the influenza, and of course, he would know about COVID-19. Dr. Yang Mi Ji also advises the WHO, and she looks at a lot of things, especially also from the World Health Organization perspective on the blueprint to look at epidemics just like COVID. So I would like to go straight now to my guest, and maybe if you look at the cases, why is it that South Korea, and maybe according to many reports that Australia has also managed to flatten their curve. So maybe Professor Dr. John Shepherd McKenzie, can you help me here? What have been the hits and misses that have been going well for Australia, for example, and if you can also relate to South Korea?
Well, I can't say much about South Korea. That's very much Dr. G's area. But in terms of Australia, I think the most important aspects have been, first of all, the early recognition that we needed to make sure that we were prepared early. So we in fact, had a number of things happening. We had everyone coming from China had to spend 2 weeks elsewhere before they were allowed to come into Australia to be in quarantine. And then at the end of January, we actually said no one can come in from China unless they are Australian citizens, and they must also go into 2 weeks quarantine when they arrived. So we had a fairly early decision-making in terms of travel coming into Australia. Australia's always had a belief that being an island, we can keep ourselves free of diseases. It works very well for animals, animal diseases, but of course it doesn't work at all well for human diseases. We can't stop traveling. We can't stop being an international hub, if you will. So we had to take a different slant when it comes to humans. And we still try and keep our borders closed when necessary. And this is one instance where we have done that. But it's probably the only incident since the 1918 influenza outbreak. This time, we were quite good at being able to stop people coming in. And if I take one state alone, that's my own state, Western Australia, we've now had 460 cases. But of those 460 cases, 449 of them have always been travellers or contacts of travellers. So we've only had 11 cases so far, which we're not sure of the origin. Okay. So basically what we're doing, all our efforts have been very much directed at people coming into the country and making sure they go into isolation and quarantine for a certain period of time, for 2 weeks, before they can join the rest of the community. And we've been very strict about this, and I think this is now paying dividends.
If you look around the world, America has the you know, biggest number of scientists, the biggest R&D, people would think so. But now they have taken over the unflattering number of the biggest cases of COVID-19. So there have been big hits and misses. And for you, globally, what has it been?
Sorry, I didn't get the question.
Like the United States of America, they were way behind before in terms of number of cases of COVID-19 and also its fatalities. But now we hear even New York health system is being swarmed, and people might be forgiven for thinking that this won't happen to United States of America because they are the biggest economy, they have one of the best scientists and also R&D there, and yet this is happening there. So obviously there has been hits and misses around the world.
Yes, I don't think they took this very seriously initially. And they're very late to start being active in terms of quarantining and isolating people. And they felt, I think we had also the situation where the president had said, Dr. Warris is a very mild disease. So a lot of people weren't too concerned about it initially. Yeah. And I think this is really their miss, if you like, was okay. Being slow and also being given the wrong information from the highest level.
Okay. I'll come back to that from another way. But Dr. Yang Meiji, South Korea has been used as an example on how really to play this hammer and dance strategy with COVID-19, especially in flattening the curve. So what has South Korea done really well? Because from this side of the world, we've been hearing about tests, tests, tests.
So good evening. First of all, I want to thank you all for organizing this important forum. Korea applied the containment and mitigation measures together from the relatively early stage of the outbreak. And firstly, as you all know, we introduced intensive testing from a very early stage of outbreak. And there was a planning of laboratory testing right after the news of unknown pneumonia outbreak in Wuhan, China, December last year. And by the end of January, we have established 20 public health laboratories involved in testing. But testing network was further extended to include more private laboratories by early February. And starting from March 9th, 114 labs could test up to 20,000 samples per day. So far, around 460,000 people have been tested, and around 2.2% were positive for COVID-19 in Korea. But ironically, this massive screening brought Korea in the second place in terms of number of laboratory confirmed cases, and many countries imposed travel bans against people from Korea. But now, I think as global outbreak situation evolves, most countries consider Korea as a country to learn from, especially for testing system. And secondly, in terms of tracing, we heightened the screening at the point of entry very quickly, and contacts under self-quarantine were monitored by assigned as government staff through a very innovative mobile app. In case of violation of self-isolation, they could be fined or even jailed. And to make this possible, the government revised the law recently. And thirdly, for treating cases, we classify the cases based on severity. So mild cases were isolated and monitored at so-called community treatment support centers. And these are not hospitals, but public or private facilities which are normally used for the retreat. And healthcare workers will monitor those people at the treatment center twice a day. And fourthly, social distancing started also from an early stage of outbreak. And although we have not locked down the country, people are staying home as much as they can. A government initial recommendations of social distancing until yesterday was extended for two more weeks until April 9th. Mm-hmm. So as a summary, I think early preparation in response to the outbreak and intensive contact tracing and easy access to testing and efficient treatment of cases according to the severity And lastly, voluntary social distancing guided by the government were the key actions.
Dr. Yang Meiji, how much does the experience of facing the threats of before, you know, before COVID-19, if you look at the same family of coronavirus, you look at stuff like SARS and also later on MERS-CoV, for example, and previous experience has given the public health system in South Korea the ability to not only have readiness in terms of mass testing, but also the trust of the people towards the government in actually running and implementing what's needed to be done here. Would you agree so?
Yes, of course. There were much lessons learned from past experiences, and we have learned from swine flu in 2009 and Zika in 2016. But above all, 2015 MERS outbreak in Korea made all the changes. After the MERS outbreak in 2015, government established number one, dedicated emergency operation center at Korea CDC as a control tower of public health emergencies related to emerging infectious diseases. Number two, dedicated center for laboratory diagnosis to coordinate nationwide laboratory testing and fast-track approval of testing kits from the Ministry of Food and Drug Safety. And this was very important for COVID-19. And also expanded the hospital facilities, including negative pressure rooms and infection prevention control among hospitals. And also a risk communication team was established at Korea CDC to provide clear messages with very transparent information in a prompt manner to the public and media. And all these changes based on the lessons learned from 2015 MERS outbreak clearly played a significant role in responding to COVID-19 in a very efficient way.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. Professor, if I can go back to you, sure. Australia also went for social distancing, which is a bit voluntary, but as the figures and facts are coming in, then the political leadership decided to go for a stronger imposition, like only two people can be in public and all this stuff. So do you think that was also a game changer by moving, by hindsight, a bit earlier than what people expected it to be from a popular politics kind of opinion? So that helped put the numbers where they are in Australia right now.
I think in part. I think we had a few misses as we went along. I think some of the messages weren't that clear from the government, and they changed their minds once or twice in terms of what they were going to do. But on the whole, the social distancing and the quarantine, isolation of people coming into the country, all together, and also making quite sure we follow up, contact trace all the cases that are found, I think all this together has made it much more effective over the last two or three weeks and beginning to flatten the curve. I think it's really a combination of things, but I think social distancing and quarantine or isolation of people unless they go out for food or for pharmaceuticals and this kind of thing, by making quite sure that people aren't gathering together more than two people at any one time, all these things I think have had a very big effect over the last two or three weeks.
As we've seen in other places around the world, sometimes it takes only one big gathering or one big factor. And for Australia, if I take away the numbers that were contributed by the cruise ship, that would rather bring down or skew the curve even lower. So what's your view on that?
I think you're quite right. I think we've had two cruise ships which have had a big effect, particularly. One, of course, was the one in Japan, where a lot of people came back from there and came down with illness. They're put into quarantine when they came back, but then they came down with disease during the quarantine, and quite a number did. That had a very early effect. But more recently, we had another cruise liner called the Ruby Princess, I think, that came into Sydney, and all the people were allowed off that ship, probably illegally now, we believe, and that had an enormous effect. There's been about 600 cases all over the country that we can connect back to that one cruise ship.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Yang Meiji, if I can go back to you, South Africa, South Korea seems to be, you know, controlling it very well at first, until what with hindsight now we know of a large gathering, a religious gathering in Daeju, if I pronounce that correctly. So, can you impact into that? Because sometimes you can have all this system, but one leak of one incident of a big gathering, for example, can really derail everything.
That's very true. And so because of that, until we found that gathering was the problem, we were managing very well. But from that moment, we were really panicked. And we tried to really test all those contacts of that special religious group. And because of that, actually, we have a lot of the cases in 20s, very young age. Our age distribution curve is quite unique because of that group. And we also found some other religious groups which were also doing similar practice. So we all government banned all those gathering of religious groups for all different religions. So that's very strictly strictly controlled now.
Dr. Yang Meiji, what happened when that cluster, if I can call it that, of the religious gathering, because hospitals around Daeju, for example, they were ready, but suddenly they didn't expect that, and the system was swamped. The reason I'm asking is because Malaysia is now under a movement control order, but there's still some pockets of society, even in Malaysia right now, that still defy the MCO, as we call it here. So maybe the lesson learned from there, because for me, when I'm reading back all the journalistic pieces on what happened in South Korea, everything was under control. But even in Daeju, they were swarmed just by this one cluster.
So we actually, when we found those clustering cases among special religious group or nursing hospitals or nursing homes, or even some major hospitals, we tried to trace all the cases. We shut down the hospital, and we had to trace all the people exposed in those special settings, and very extensive testing has been done. So we have done a lot of testing for those settings, and we found even the asymptomatic cases, a lot of them were asymptomatic, but we still found the viruses. But still, those asymptomatic cases can spread viruses, as you know. So we found one-third of the cases, confirmed cases, were asymptomatic. But it is, I think, important to detect all those asymptomatic cases because they can still spread virus.
Okay. I have to rest this discussion for a while. We have to go for a break. But before that, I would like to throw a question out. You know, the signs are very clear, even though there's so many more questions that we want to know about the virus, especially towards the cure or vaccines for it. But before we go there, and I remember reading about Prof also, Professor, you know, one of the things you want to do is to let the public and policymakers really be aware of any epidemic, whether that happens here or around the world. So with hindsight now, and as we go for the break, I'll give you time to think about this, the science are quite clear on this, but the decision whether it should be early or later or hard or lesser, as Dr. Tedros of WHO has said, he was very frustrated, even though a lot of messages was given out by WHO, but countries around the world seems to hesitate in taking the right moves. So I'm just asking from the two experiences in Australia and in South Korea, you know, how can we manage this better in linking the science, public health, and also the decisions, hard decisions, but must be taken, because the earlier it's being taken, the better it is that it could be moving forward. So we go for a short break, but the answer after the short break. The coronavirus COVID-19 is claiming a total of 1.286 million people around the world right now to be infected. And the total death number now stands at more than 70,482. In fact, might have grown more from these stats that I'm reading out to you. So I'm going to go back to Professor Shepherd McKenzie here. And WHO has been warning China since the second week of January has even sequenced the genome, and they've been putting out data out there. WHO, through its nearly daily press conferences and communique, has been addressing the issue and telling countries around the world to do more on it. But like we can see here, South Korea, which was very close to China in the beginning a few weeks ago, is now not even in the top 10. And if you look at the top 10 countries, they are mostly well-developed nations in Europe and the United States of America. So, Professor Shepherd McKenzie, if you can please share with us, from your vantage point of view, it's not that easy to communicate the science when you have social, economical and political consideration at the same time.
Absolutely correct. And I think this is one of the things that frustrated Dr. Tedros very much. As much as he warned the world what to expect and to ask the world to prepare and get ready for this spreading to their countries, most countries didn't listen to him. And I think this is one of the things that, in hindsight, they would probably now wish they had. Certainly the ones in Europe and also in the US. I think, on the other hand, countries in Asia who had previously experienced SARS and so on, I think they were much more ready to be able to understand the risks and also be able to develop plans to make sure that they were ready for this to happen again. So I think that there was a very big difference between Europe and the developed countries, if you will, and countries in Asia which had experienced SARS previously and so forth, who were much more ready and much more able to respond.
So, before I go to Dr. Yang Meiji, Professor, do you think that the biggest leadership role of the government in times like these, very unprecedented, very difficult times, which one is a more important trait? Is it transparency? Is it preparedness from before? Or is it quick response or responsiveness to be agile, to pivot, to adapting to the rising pandemic?
I think it's probably all three to some degree. I think certainly it's very important to have some pandemic planning in place. And one of the things that's helped Australia certainly has been having the influenza pandemic plan well organised and ready to go at a moment's notice. Although there are many differences between influenza and COVID-19, there certainly is a lot of similarity in terms of how you respond. So I think in that sense, having those pandemic plans ready was very, very important. I think also, though, being able to get all your country behind you in terms of being able to be very transparent what's happening is absolutely crucial. That transparency was really important in Singapore and also in South Korea, as Dr. Lee will tell us in a moment. But I think that we were much better able to respond quickly to many countries in Europe which have much more bureaucratic processes in place, making it much harder for them to respond rapidly.
Okay. Dr. Yang Meiji, if you can, look back at the South Korean strategy, one is we've talked a bit before, alluding to the preparedness from the previous viruses. But what gives the political will a better, speedier decision on this as compared to many other developed nations, for example?
So, as Professor McKenzie mentioned, because of our previous experience in MERS, made us possible to prepare better. But still, this is a new virus, so we know little about this virus. So at the beginning, we are not quite sure to what extent we need to really put on for action. But I think we did our best by putting containment measures as well as mitigation measures together from the very early stage, and especially for the testing, we have prepared a lot. But for other aspects, we tried our best, but there were some consideration for the economy. So on a high level, we had to I think there was a lot of discussion considering our economy, but in the end, I think we did best for the public health rather than economy at the moment. So,
Dr. Yang Meiji, how easy or difficult was it? You work with WHO, but in your own country, surely your advice is very much sought by the leaders. How easy or difficult it is to put across the sciences when you have to go up against economic consideration? For example, stopping the flights coming from infected areas in Wuhan and Hubei to South Korea. It was not that easy of a decision, but from the science perspective, it's so easy. But from the other side, any single flight that we let through is causing us a potential problem for the future. And now we know they did cause us problem. So from your own perspective, from the experience in Seoul and in South Korea?
Well, of course, it was a very difficult decision. But at the beginning, actually, they probably wanted to close everything from China, not only from Wuhan. But we couldn't do it. It was difficult decision, but for the public health point of view, it was better to just close everything down, everything closed from China. But it was not possible to really do that. So there was kind of consideration for both sides in the end, but for those flights coming from China. But I think the important thing was our communication with the public and media. We really did a lot of daily briefing. Actually, we did daily briefing twice a day, actually, in the morning, in the afternoon. So we tried to provide updated information for everything to the public and media. And that really provided the big trust in government action. So I think that was really key for this whole process.
Dr. Yang, it seems like closing the border is an automatic go-to action. But like we have discussed, mass meetings or, you know, any meetings that have a lot of people during that time, how can that surveillance be incorporated into the standard operating procedure of public health now, with hindsight, not only for South Korea, but for countries around the world, the lessons learned from here? Because apparently there's more measures to put a silo or a wall between countries, but within a country, there seems still to be, you know, here and there, that has not really been looked at.
Well, I think we are doing our best, but it's not really imposed by the government as like law. Yeah. Some countries really put a lot of restriction, but in our case, just for voluntarily. But still, I think it works. The people, when they go out, when they have to go out, really, then they will mask, and everybody is wearing mask actually when they go out. Some people even wearing the mask even in their own car, and in indoors, of course, everybody is wearing the mask. But even they go walk on the street, they will wear the mask. And so the personal hygiene has been really, really emphasized from the beginning. Yeah. And and the social distancing.
Yes.
We try to really do our best, but it's only voluntary basis.
Yes, understood. Sometimes you cannot control what you cannot control, but from the public health perspective, you do control the equipments and the preparations, like now people talk about PPE, masks, ventilators, testing kits, for example. But I want to ask you this, Dr. Yang Meiji, because how do you prepare so many in stock, for example, testing kits and reagent when there's no epidemic or pandemic? Because that's a cost that has got to be accounted for. Certain countries can't even get close to that level. And now, certain countries want to do massive testing. They have the test kits, but they can't get the reagent fast enough. But in the case of South Korea, it seems that the public health system has managed to lobby the leadership on that.
So there was the preparation in the very early stage, right after we have the information from China. So as I mentioned, there was private-public collaboration, including the pharmaceutical companies which produce those kits, and with the Ministry of Food and Drug Safety. For emergency use licensing and production of those test kits was most critical part at the very early stage. And so we were able to really produce a lot of testing kits from the beginning. And we have extended the number of the laboratories which can test COVID-19, including the private labs. Okay. And also to increase the number of testing, we also introduced some innovative sampling methods like drive-through and walk-through testing centers. Mm-hmm. And this turned out to be quite effective way to really increase the number of testing.
Professor Shepherd McKenzie, the readiness of the public health system in Australia to face this, because now we see the gaps that has been showed by the pandemic, which is if you already have a fragile public health system, this is going to only exacerbate the issues during the pandemic. How is it for Australia and the preparedness of the public health system?
Well, I think the public health system was really very well prepared because of the various exercises they've done in the past over for pandemic influenza and for that potential to happen. So I think on one hand, the health service was really very ready to get behind the government and ensuring that all that could be done was being done. But we also had good stockpiles of many of the PPE requirements. But what we didn't have was enough ventilators, nor do we have enough testing kits. So this was a problem for the early stages. We managed to get much more now in terms of PPE. We managed to get more ventilators, but still we could do with more. I think that we had a problem with the number of testing kits for quite a while. Most of the testing that was done on people who either people who had travelled or people with contacts who had travelled and who had now coming down with pneumonia, sore throat, cough and so forth. So only a certain number of people were being tested. That is more or less still the case, although the requirement of having to be in contact with someone who's travelled is less important now. Yeah. Now we need to persuade or close the borders, travellers aren't coming in. Mm-hmm. And so the efforts now are being directed towards people who are ill. Yeah. We don't have enough kits, however, to look at asymptomatic cases like Dr. G was saying a short time ago. Yes. We would love to do that, but we still don't have enough kits for doing that. Mm-hmm. But I think it's very important as the program goes on that we will have to try and do this and if we can get more kits.
Professor, you do know that the testings done in Australia is like more than 300,000 tests already. It's like 7 to 8 times more than Malaysia, but you're still advocating more mass tests compared to that.
Yes. I think we also need to know much more about this, about the transmission cycles, about the number of asymptomatic cases in the community, okay. which can basically transmit the virus without you realising it.
Okay.
So we need to know, have a much better handle on that. All our testing up to now has been done on people who have been travelling or who have been associated with travellers.
Yes. I want to touch upon... Yeah, sorry, yeah. Professor, but I want to get on to that pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic transmission risk or hazards. If I can leverage on you on that, then I'll go to Dr. Yang Meiji, because a few days ago there was a paper or research published by Singapore where they really followed cases across, and they, of course, it's not entirely exhaustive, but from the data that they have that far, it did show there's a potential of asymptomatic transmission that has happened. So where do you stand on the, pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic transmission? Because right now, most of the countries in the world are only fighting the ones that we can see and with the symptoms.
This is a big worry. I think we don't know to what extent the asymptomatic transmission or the pre-symptomatic transmission is affecting the numbers of cases and the chains of transmission, which we, in countries that we're unaware of. So I think there's no question that, in my mind, that there is significant amounts of asymptomatic transmission and almost certainly transmission in the first in a day or two prior to symptoms arising. So these really are the most important thing ways that this virus is going to spread in the community. We don't know if people are infected, and there's no reason why we should be isolating them. We just don't understand. We don't know, basically. So one of the problems is that if we can, or one of the things is if we can discover more about this transmission within our the different communities, we can then tailor our responses to be able to try and nip to the bud some of these chains of transmission that are occurring underneath in terms of our awareness, shall we say.
Understood.
So yes, it's actually very important to understand and very important to be able to test for it.
Dr. Yang Meiji, can you weave in your expert opinion on pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic transmission?
So as I mentioned already, we found that around one-third of cases were asymptomatic, partly because we had quite young group of people from the religious group. Many of them, I think, were asymptomatic. But in general, we count all those cases so far, was one-third, I think, was asymptomatic, which is very high. And I heard that today asymptomatic cases could be even higher, maybe just half of the total cases. So the virus spread from those asymptomatic cases really can be a big problem. So, but in my country, actually, we tried to do all those contact tracing 2 days before the symptom, the confirmation of all the cases, even regardless of symptoms. So we tried to really trace all those contacts of the cases, the asymptomatic cases, including asymptomatic cases. So, but that is still the big challenge, and especially in Seoul, the capital city, where there is a huge population. Once we just miss those asymptomatic cases, it can just spread like fire. So that's actually our worry. Even though we now have less than 50 cases, today we had 47 cases, new cases. But we are still worried about the capital city with a huge population.
Okay.
We might expect another peak if we miss some of those silent transmissions.
Okay, I have to rest it for the final time, but again, I want to throw my questions first, but mostly I want to look at the science of it and what do we know about SARS-CoV-2 or this pandemic COVID-19 so far, and what's crucial about what we do not know for us to keep on plugging at. For example, who and where and what will be the cure or the vaccine, who will get it first, and not only getting it, but how do we make it available to around the world? And we'd like to quote Bill Gates on that, saying that yes, we could go back to normal, but that would mean that everyone around the world who has this needs to have access to the cure. So we go for a short break, then we'll ask Professor and Doctor these questions. You are still watching Agenda Awani Plus, and during the last segment, I just want to go straight with the two scientists. What have we known about this virus that's very crucial for what we're doing right now, and what haven't we known that we must find the answer to for us to solve this maybe once and for all? So with that, I would like to go to Professor Shepherd McKenzie first.
I think what we've known now is how the virus transmits. We know roughly what the R0 number is, and we know quite a bit about how people can contract the virus. What we don't know, what's really very important, is we don't know yet the percentage of asymptomatic cases, which we've just been talking about. But secondly, we don't know yet why some people get very severe infections and others don't. Even in younger people, we find some younger people get very severe infections and others have barely any infection at all. We don't know why some people are older and suddenly get a very severe infection in the second week, why they suddenly go downhill very rapidly and others don't. There's so much we don't understand about the pathogenesis of the virus still, or the pathology. I think very important to remember from previous discussion and also for this bit as well, that viruses don't move. People move. Viruses can't spread. People remember to undertake social distancing.
Okay.
So if everyone should practice social distancing, the virus would die out.
Okay.
So I think these are the messages we need to get across. That, but in terms of the knowledge now that we have this virus, how it transmits, we know much more now also about its stability in the environment, how long it will last for, and on hard surfaces and so forth. These are very important aspects of being able to control the virus in the long term. But we still don't know much about the pathogenesis, and we really do need to know that, particularly when it comes to vaccines later on. Thank you.
Dr. Yang Meiji.
So, apart from what Professor McKenzie mentioned, as this is a new virus, we really know little about this virus, and we really need to work harder to have more evidence, more scientific evidence, especially for the immunity. And if we want to have an effective vaccine, obviously this is going to be very important. And we really have to share the information as much as possible. So I think one of the misses in Korea was we have worked very hard, but I think in terms of analyzing data, which we accumulated so far, I think we need to do more to have more data analysis for the epidemiological information and clinical information. And those will be very important for our future research and development work for COVID-19.
Yes.
We have actually started the global R&D collaboration right after the public health emergency declaration in January. So we all need to work together really to understand the virus, and including not only the developed countries, but including the resource-limited settings.
Resource poor, Dr. Yang Meiji, if you can also straight away go, will we see a vaccine or a drug or a cure within the next year or so? Because that seems to be the hope of many.
Well, I think I think best expectation would be probably one and a half year. I know that Dr. Anthony Fauci from US NIH said at least one to one and a half years, and it will take at least that much time. So I think until then we need to probably do the research on the treatment using the existing drugs, drug repositioning studies that's ongoing in many countries, in many institutions, including, I think, all of us. So that probably should be done very quickly as a substitute. And also the plasma therapy, we have done also for the MERS cases in 2015. So those, the recovered patient. From the recovered patient, we tried to use the plasma to get the antibodies. So that probably can be another alternative. So we are also, we have started the clinical trial for that as well. So for the vaccine, I think we still have to wait.
Professor Shepherd McKenzie, on the cure or the vaccine or the drug?
I think what Dr. G said is quite correct. I don't think we'll have a vaccine for a year to 18 months, somewhere of that kind of nature. Some of them are going to animal trials now. One of them at least has gone into human safety trials. But there's a long way to go still. I mean, so I don't think we'll see a vaccine until in the middle of next year. In the therapeutics, I think there are a number of potential things that are happening which might lead to something in the next few months. But again, once again, these things take time, and we have to go through safety trials. Even drugs that we do know well, like hydroxychloroquine, that Mr. Trump has been trumping about, and other ones such as ivermectin, another one that's been mentioned recently. These are all drugs which have already been passed for use in other areas, and they could probably be used much more rapidly if they are found to be effective.
Yes.
I think we'll probably find, if there are any therapeutic drugs that are used, it'll probably be in combination. There'll be more than one at a time.
Okay.
Whereas I think most of the drugs we've looked at so far have probably little evidence that they work individually.
Okay.
But it's quite likely that one or two of them might work in combination.
Okay.
So I think there's much more work that can be done there and is being done as we speak.
Okay. Before I close, just a short answer from the both of you. So from the science of it, it is telling us that until we find the cure, so this is going to be a new normal where social distancing is the rule of the day. Professor Shepherd McKenzie?
I think it's going to be the rule of the day for a while to come, sadly. I think a lot of the things we've been hoping to get back to a sense of normality is going to be quite a while yet, unfortunately.
Dr. Yang Yiji?
Yes, I also think even though we live the social distancing officially, we still have to do some minimum extent of social distancing at least. And also we have to really work together. And I hope that this kind of online forum will be very useful to share our knowledge and experience. And perhaps we could invite more countries next time, including Malaysia.
Yeah.
Because you have not heard about Malaysia today, so it would be nice to hear more from your country as well.
Yeah. Doctor, you are on that. I'll take you up on that. If you can link us to the authorities and the media there, we'll do a Malaysian-South Korea discussion on this. So I would like to do that also with Professor and Australia. I mean, if we work together, the whole countries around the world, we could probably manage this pandemic and the next one, if ever it happens, better. Thank you so much to Professor. Thank you so much to Doctor. And thanks to you for watching Agenda Awani Plus. And together, stay at home. Professor has said it well. The virus doesn't move around the world. We do. So we stop moving. We stop touching one another. We social distance and we wash our hands like Dr. Tedros wants us to do it. So we might see a semblance of normalcy, if not normalcy. Good night and goodbye.